damn late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
Well, it's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again. You've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
But we ain't killing they army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, Ben, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, on the line, I got Mike Swanson from WallStreetWindow.com. And author of the great book, The War State. You know, about the war state. Welcome back to the show. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. How you doing?
I'm real good. Listen, I'm very happy to have you on the show because I'm interested in what's going on in the markets, but I'm not interested enough that I pay close enough attention. But I need to catch up sometimes. And so, there's the business community and there's the banks and the arms manufacturers and the federal government and the Federal Reserve and its monetary policy. And especially, boy, in Trump years, we have the president and his trade policy and all of these things interacting and conflicting and complementing each other in various ways. And so, you know, I'm just interested in where we're at and where we're headed. So maybe start with the breaking news, if you want, about Trump laying 5% tariffs on Mexico until they abolish immigration to the United States?
Well, the market stuff, we'll get to the news and then the market stuff. The market stuff's actually easier to understand in a certain sense. But the news items at this point, I believe that one in particular is confusing. First of all, it's a declaration of an intention to lay a tariff. So is it going to happen or not? I don't know. I don't really understand the point of it. Some of this stuff, it just gets to a point where it makes me wonder, is there a real strategy with these tariffs? Because he's got a tariff war going on in China. He's got one going on of Canada and Europe and all these, you know, all over the place. And the China situation is interesting because reading the Wall Street Journal over the past year and, you know, other publications, it seemed clear to me that he is a firm believer in tariffs against China. He's got advisors around him, such as Peter Navarro and this Lighthizer character who's been in charge of the negotiations, who actually was the personal lawyer of Wilbur Ross, and they're firm believers in permanent tariffs and using them as a tool to try to make in their minds America stronger in the world and try to push down China, so to speak, or at least thwart their growth, and not really a negotiation tool to make them buy more stuff or whatever. But that's what's in the newspaper publications. But if you watch the financial media, up until this month, the story was, well, they're going to make a deal and then the market's going to take off more and it's just a negotiating tactic and everything's going to be good. And it doesn't, at this point, obviously, that doesn't seem to be the case at all. And those negotiations are completely broken down. And China's made two interesting statements this week in their media, or last week, the premier made some statement that to the Chinese people in a speech that they have to now prepare for a long march. Now, you got to go back to the Chinese revolution and Mao to know what that means. And what that was a year-long retreat in the Chinese Civil War. So he's basically telling them, buckle your seats or buckle your belts and prepare to suffer for a year. And then one of their state media publications had the quote, don't say we warn you. And you, and that's something these publications, the state media said right before the Cuban Missile Crisis. And what happened during the Cuban Missile Crisis is China invaded India and beat, militarily defeated their armies, but didn't, but just stopped, but scared the bejesus out of them, to say the least. Mm-hmm. And they also use that statement when China, I mean, as Americans, we don't remember these events. First one overshadowed by the Cuban Missile Crisis, but China also invaded Vietnam around in the late 1970s, and they made that same statement then. And now they lost, like, both sides lost about 30,000 people. So when I see these statements, it makes me think that China has given up on negotiations and they're preparing to do something. I don't know what. Something dramatic in a year. Maybe if Trump doesn't win, they won't do anything. I don't know, but they're definitely. But it's just a sign of tension. And then today, as you mentioned, this Mexican thing. I don't know if that's real or if that's. I wonder if this what it was is Trump said he's going to put tariffs on Mexico because they're exporting illegal immigrants to the United States, and I don't. Maybe that's a propaganda thing to try to tell his base of supporters that, look, tariffs are not just about China, but they're about stopping illegal immigrants, so they're good. It seems nonsensical to me that that's any sort of real tactic.
So I see what you're saying. And then, so to get back to China, though, for a minute there, that, well, sort of like with Iran, there is no better deal. You're not going to get a better deal, or certainly not acting this way. And you're saying that it's pretty clear that he doesn't want a better deal. He wants essentially a complete regime change from America's post-Cold War free trade, freer trade policy back toward real older protectionism. And so in that sense, then the Mexico news from this morning is again just another pretext, and I guess kill two birds with one stone there. If he wants to keep Mexican goods or American goods produced in Mexico as well as Mexican nationals out of the country.
I think that's correct. With China specifically, what has been in the journal and other publications is that they want China, it's not so much about the trade deficit, but they want China to stop state subsidy of many of their companies, their industrial policy, which means basically changing their whole form of government, I would think. And you see what they do with Iran, Venezuela, with Mexico. I don't really know. I mean, I maybe we should just take it literally. He wants them to do something about illegal immigration. But it's obviously this has become, you know, a tool of foreign policy and not simply trade, is the way it appears to me. And I'm not going to try to – it is what it is. I'm not necessarily trying to pass judgment on it. But I don't – I don't. You know, is it effective? I don't know. And it does seem like it is going to push Iran and China and Russia in some closer together in the long run.
Well, now, politically, Trump needs a strong economy going into 2020. And is this, you know, pretty much along the lines of the Smoot-Hawley tariff and this kind of thing that everybody says? Boy, of all of the decisions that Hoover made in getting the New Deal started before FDR even got there, that was the worst decision of all. That in the middle of, obviously, there's a lot of downsides to these tariffs and a reduction in international trade. Trump's betting on some kind of long-term result, and I guess he's betting on interest rates staying low and growth staying at a, you know, as they measure it, at a reasonable clip in spite of these tariffs, or he's betting that in the long run it'll be good for the economy anyway to have these tariffs to build up American industry again or something like that.
Well, I mean, on the face of it, you would assume that tariffs aren't going to be good for the economy and therefore not good for Trump. because of that. And a year ago or 6 months ago, I would easily think it'll hurt him politically. However, it does appear, again, I'm just getting this from the Times or the Journal or somewhere, but he's made a decision over the past couple weeks or have come to the conclusion that politically the tariff wars might actually help him, especially in regards to China, because there's hints that when 2020 comes around, he's going to run as a tough leader on U.S. foreign policy against our potential enemies, particularly China and Iran, and portray whoever the Democrats nominate as weak on both those issues, especially Joe Biden. Biden's already said something about, we don't need tariffs on China or something to that effect. So Trump can position himself as the man who's tough against the Dems. And I think on that sense, he thinks it's going to help him, especially, Venezuela and Iran, the Republican Party, or at least the conservative movement, are on his side on both those issues.
Well, and that assumes, though, that these policies don't tip us into recession, right?
Well, I think if it does, and I think we could be headed that way anyway, and I'll explain why in a little bit, but if it does, he can say, look, China is causing this. we're in a tariff war, and you got to be patriotic about it. And then he's also already positioned himself to blame the Federal Reserve for raising rates too much. He's done that over the past, really since the fall, multiple times, and he's had his advisors do that. Say the Fed shouldn't raise rates, or they should lower rates. They're the cause of it. So he's already going to blame others no matter what. And, last year, one of the most amazing things I've ever seen on my television set was the stock market, the economy, and the currency of Turkey last August crashed. It's a total, they're still in a crisis. Unemployment there is almost 18%. And the leader of Turkey gave a speech last August or early September telling the people to sell any gold and silver they have to buy the Turkish lira to support it. And whether they have it or not, the crowd was just cheering and clapping that. So that tells me some of these world leaders, they can keep their core support, even if some of their actions are the cause for whatever calamity befalls people.
Yeah, we love sacrifice. It makes us feel important.
So I feel like we're in a moment, or in some ways people may have been feeling this way in 2008 and since Trump won, but I heard someone make the statement that the Cold War era ended, when the Berlin Wall fell, and now we're in the Trump era. Well, I don't really think that's true, but we're obviously not in the Cold War era, and the 9/11 terrorist stuff, maybe that era has, that chapter has turned too, and we are entering in some something is happening, or we're heading towards something, and part of it, I believe is the stock market and the economy. Because what's happened there is, I think we last spoke in January and the market fell about 20% in the first quarter, and it's gone. It went back up more than I thought it would, but now it appears to have peaked out again. And I interpreted the drop in December as part of a cycle shift, much like the summer 2007 or 2000. Which would lead to a bear market and lead to ultimately, which is probably more important, a recession. And the bond market is more important than the stock market in terms of forecasting that. And it's giving the same warning signs that it did in 2000, 2007. So if you look in the financial press, you'll see now all these stories that 3-month treasury bond interest rates are now yielding a higher rate than 10-year rates. And these are, bought and sold by individuals, everywhere. And what this means is you get less interest if you lend money to the government for 10 years than you do for 3 months, which is abnormal. It should be the opposite. But it's doing this because this is happening because people are assuming that in the long run now that interest rates are actually going to decline. And they do that when they think the Fed's going to have to lower rates or there's going to be a recession. And there's something called the Fed Fund Futures Market where people bet on this. And that market's pricing in about a 90% chance of a rate cut by January. And as of yesterday, over 55% chance one is by September. Now, that's not going to happen unless the stock market declines first or there's signs of a real slowdown in the economy. So I think that's where we're really headed for next year. And I don't blame it on tariffs. I mean, it's just these cycles play out over time, and recessions are just a natural part of the business cycle anyway. So when I think of it that way, it's not that big of a deal, and bear markets happen too. And I think of the stock market action last fall and so far this year is just a very long, drawn out topping process that will lead to a bear market by the end of this year, next year.
Bear Stearns crashed in what, spring of 07? It took another year and a half for the whole thing to completely fall apart.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And it's a yield curve inversion about the interest rates on the short term and long term of the bond occurring with a 3-month 10-year. That actually started in 2006 when the real estate prices peaked out. And then, as you mentioned, Bear Stearns blew up a year later. So these things take time to play mm-hmm. out. And the thing about these bear markets is the last two that we've experienced, they're also big bubbles in the economy that blew up. The first time was internet stuff. The last one, much more serious with real estate and these mortgage-backed securities. It took the banking, made the banks basically insolvent. And this time, the last one was fascinating because it was actually fairly evident. I believe that those problems were there, and it took a year for it to matter in the stock market. I didn't really understand. I mean, I saw the Bear Stearns story. It was in June, July of 2007. And in January 2008, I read an article that just laid it all out, that these banks' balance sheets are bankrupt, and it's just the facts are there. There was an article in Barron's in the summer 2008 that Freddie Mae and Fannie Mae were going to go bankrupt. And it wasn't until like over 90 days later that they crashed. But this time I got to say these things because I can't really, there's things I worry about that I think could be bubbles that could explode one day. But I can't point to any signs to say that they've topped out or that, hey, this is really going to blow up. So specifically, the thing that I see is the most, well, two things that are the most dangerous potentially is government debt itself. And if you listen to Ron Paul and some experts in Austrian economics, a lot of them will say that, look, the 2008 crisis, they just took the problems on the bank balance sheets and put them on the Federal Reserve balance sheet, and it's going to blow up one day. And now the U.S. debt to GDP is over 100%, which historically ends up causing a problem with funding of this debt, which would mean a bond bear market. Well, we're not in a bond bear market. But the other aspect of that is corporate debt is at also the highest level, ever. And that's thanks in part to the Federal Reserve doing what they did the last two times, lowering rates and keeping them too low for too long. And, we had the lowest interest rates for corporate bonds around 2016 ever in recorded history. So we now have this massive bond debt. A lot of it's been used to buy back shares. But frankly, there's companies I don't think would even exist without it, such as Tesla. and even Netflix. Netflix has like $8 billion in debt. And even though I like it, I'm a customer of it, they don't make a profit. So I don't know if these companies could exist without the low rates we have. But the thing about the real estate bubble, it was kind of obvious that something was wrong there. The real estate prices peaked in 2006 and were already declining before that Bear Stearns thing blew up. But these corporate bonds, they're not going down in value, really. So there's like a exchange traded fund. The symbol's LQD, and another one TLT, which is LQD is for the corporate bonds, TLT is for treasury bonds. And I think if this is really going to be a problem, it would show up with the corporate bonds falling first. So if they fall like 20% off a high, and TLT is still going up, that would be a warning sign, like Bear Stearns blowing up and something to that effect. But that's not happening. But if I see that happen next year, then I'll be getting scared.
Hey, guys, check out Listen and Think audiobooks. They're at listenandthink.com and, of course, on audible.com. And they feature my book, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, as well as brand new out Inside Syria by our friend Reese Ehrlich and a lot of other great books. Mostly by libertarians there. Reese might be one exception, but essentially they're all libertarian audiobooks. And here's how you can get a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think audiobooks. Just donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate. So speaking of all of that, let me go to Rothbard 101 here. So this is just from the central banking chapter in For a New Liberty. And he says the same thing in the case against the Fed and what has government done to our money and all that. But the simplest kind of case of it, he says that, look, they always inflate and they inflate and they inflate until they get afraid and they get worried that they've distorted the market in this, that, or the other thing too much. Usually the stock market, or as you know, we've seen dot-coms or housing or whatever it is, or they get worried about upward pressure on wages across the board, which they always want to oppose, and they always will blame overall price inflation on wages going up instead of blaming wages going up on cost of living increases due to the price inflation. But anyway, at some point they get worried that they've allowed too much bank credit expansion, and so they start raising the interest rates, and always just a little bit at a time, because they want to cool the irrational exuberance but without causing a crash. But they always cause a crash, because as Rothbard says, you can't prick a small hole in the bubble and let the air come out. The bubble pops, and there's no way really to undo that. So when you talk about, people are predicting that they're going to end up lowering interest rates, isn't it the case, if they've already started raising them, that they're going to at least hold them or keep raising them because they don't want to lower them, either for political reasons, just that they want to see the crash happen on Trump's watch in order to make sure that he's not reelected, or just because overall they're worried that they've Q1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 the hell out of everything, and they're afraid that essentially the Austrians are right about the distortions and about the inflation of different prices in different sectors, and that we better have a correction now before we have a correction later and it's that much worse.
Well, I would say that's true, but they have another fear that seems to always displace the fear that they've gone too far in helping fuel these bubbles, and that is one I don't really understand, but there's a book called Greenspan's Bubbles, and it's old. It's written in 2008, but it's examines Federal Reserve transcripts of Alan Greenspan. Mm-hmm. And
that's interesting.
In him, he displays a fear a couple times. It's like you said, he was scared in 2000 that they're inflating things too much. We got to raise interest rates. And he actually did a rate hike after the market broke in April that year. It fell like 20%. And he still raised them again. really because of what you're talking about, that, well, you know, this has gotten out of control. And then they'll make the statement that, and they have done this, Powell did it last year, that we need to raise rates even as much as we basically can. So when the next downturn comes, we'll have ammunition to keep lowering them, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So, that's the best you're ever going to get out of these guys. So, that's so funny.
So he said that. Yeah, Powell said that last year. Greenspan made this crazy statement that people are making too much money and we got to stop it. He actually said that. So, but
meant it literally, making too much money. That is a problem.
Yeah, maybe he did. What this book has in it is a couple times he expresses this fear, and he did it first and during the 1987 stock market crash, and then in the fall of 2000, that somehow or another, if things fell too much, if the stock market fell too much, that the whole money system or money itself, the U.S. dollar, would just stop flowing, and people would stop trading stocks, and everything would just freeze up somehow. And that's actually happened in Russia in 1998. Their stock market crashed so much that people stopped trading for a couple weeks. But it doesn't cause the end of the world. And, you know, bottomed out just bottomed out. So for some reason, they seem to have this fear that things could just, you know, crash and just maybe. And I think that's what they're scared of in 2008, too. But it's the point is that when the market ends up falling, they seem to overreact by lowering rates, or they're scared of this, scared of something happening, the whole system melting down, and they, you know, their fear of, you know, the bubble's gotten too big becomes replaced with this, what seems to be a greater fear that the whole system could just pop, basically. Mm-hmm. Although I don't really quite understand how that's really possible. I don't understand how you could just pop capitalism and just any kind, you know, the whole world economy. You know, but I don't think of stocks and bonds as maybe being the whole world, you know, being capitalism.
Yeah. You know? Well, so David Stockman, he talks about the Great Deformation, really, since World War II, right? Where he says, and this is all just a construct, I don't know, you know. But he's saying essentially you have this one big bubble since then. And then you have all these other bubbles are sort of these smaller bubbles. You can picture a soap bubble with smaller bubbles attached to it, right? But the one kind of mothership bubble that they're all attached to. And so you have, you know, the whole 70s stagflation era there. Then you have the crash at the end of the Carter years and beginning of Reagan, and then you have the build up and then the pop of 87, and then on and on, 1999, 2000, and then 2008, and then here we are. But that essentially, that big bubble, that's the dollar bubble. But it seems like that doesn't seem to be what you're referring to, though, or what they're referring to, that they're afraid that they're gonna pop the dollar bubble itself, because that's really the risk they're running in trying to prop up all these smaller bubbles. And they seem completely ignorant of the danger that they could end up costing faith in the U.S. dollar overall, which is what you were saying is, hey, once your debt is this percent of GDP, this kind of thing, it doesn't usually work out too well.
Yeah. And there's a couple books that show that. I'm looking at one, it's free. Anyone can download it or find it if they type in big debt crisis. And it came out last year. And it just looks at all the case studies of every single time this has happened in the past 100 years, including in the United States in the 1930s. But I think Stockman's basically correct. The biggest bubble, if it could burst, would be this corporate bond bubble going down. But then the treasury bond market unwinding and going into bear market at the same time as the stock market is. And if that happened, the dollar would be going down too. That's what happened in Turkey last year. Yeah.
That's what Ron Paul is worried about too. That's what he's always warning about. That I'm not saying it's going to happen this year, but I am saying we can't go on like this. You better listen now.
But I would think the order would be the stock market going down and then bonds and the corporate bonds and then the treasury bonds. And the dollar, I don't, But that's one thing I wonder about with this whole Trump tariff thing is it's not just the United States that has these big debts. Most of Europe does. Interestingly, Russia is in a fairly good situation financially because they've ran through two of these crises lately. Well, one just a couple years ago and one in the late 90s. But so there's some countries that are financially sound, but many are in the same boat the United States is. Japan, for example, and China maybe. It's their numbers are kind of mysterious, but many. So there is a line of thought that is it possible that it's not just the United States, but most of the developed world, and therefore a possible strategy that may make sense. I'm not, and I don't know if it would even work, but could make sense of what Trump's doing with the tariffs, is let's use these tariffs to push down the rest of the world. So when this next crisis does actually come, the U.S. can kind of still maintain a place to attract money. Because if Europe is crashing worse, and the you know the money's going to flow somewhere, it's kind of a trying to make sense of it, and I don't even know if it's. I guess I'm trying to give them the benefit of the doubt, but I don't know if it would even work.
Yeah, I mean, they do seem to be trying to, come at China from every angle that they possibly can, crash coming or not, right? They're trying to limit. In fact, I read this article that talked about how essentially Trump, implied a general order to his government that, do anti-China stuff. And so there's no real central direction to it, and some of the policies are contradictory, but they all essentially have to do with, a panic about the loss of American hegemony and the rise of China in the world. And, what can we do about it? And I guess that was a thing I read in Chinese media, too, where they were saying, hey, this evinces a design to reduce us under absolute despotism. What the hell? I thought this was just a trade fight. But we're starting to see how you are here, that this is part of a broader agenda against us, which is sure to generate a severe reaction, as you talked about, pushing them toward Russia and toward China. I mean, toward the Europeans and the Europeans toward them and all that, which I don't care about that. But I can see why... the U.S. government has a lot of power to lose, but they don't know what to do other than counterproductive things, no matter what the question, as far as I can tell.
Well, one of the key concepts of the Austrian economics that I learned was that the Federal Reserve is trying to manipulate interest rates up or down, but no one knows the true exact, level that those interest rates should be at. So it's a futile exercise. And when we look at state action when it comes to, as you document in your show and your guests do, overseas in Iraq, Afghanistan, and you go back to Vietnam and all the Syria, Somalia, Libya, on and on and on. They have a mission, they think they're going to do something, and it never works out the way they think, it turns into a disaster. The planning doesn't work. Government state planning doesn't ever turn out the way people expect. So with the David Stockman thing about the dollar bubble, what's interesting about that and the Federal Reserve is from World War II or after World War II, the U.S. created something called the Bretton Woods Agreement, where the dollar, U.S. dollar internationally was linked to the price of gold. And we maintained that till 1972. And during that, that made it, though, so the U.S. couldn't run limitless government deficits without having the gold leave the country. So it was sort of a buffer on what the government could do. But one interesting thing is between World War II and the 70s, there was no giant stock market bubble or massive recession, really, that came I don't think there's a bear market more than 25% during all that time. But what happened was when LBJ was president, he busted the deficit to fund the Vietnam War and his social programs. So the gold started to leave the country and inflation picked up. The dollar actually did start to go down. And it got, the process continued every month. And by the time 1972 came around, Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard. And what's interesting about, one of the interesting things about that is I got a hold of the Federal Reserve minutes, the first meeting they held after Nixon announced that decision, and he didn't inform them. And in the meeting, they talked like, oh, this is just going to happen for a couple of weeks and we'll be back on the gold standard. Well, we're not back on it. And and really, I think of all of these big bubbles that we're talking about today, the distortions in the financial markets and the government deficit, they really accelerated since that moment. And Stockman mm-hmm. really documents that in his book. But, you know, without all those deficits, I don't know if we could have the wars we've had.
Yeah. See, left-leaning people don't want to hear that what we need is sound money, like Scrooge McDuck wants. We want only the purest capitalism is what provides for the growth of wages along with the growth of productivity. But you take us off the gold standard, you let the government create all of this money and run all of these giant deficits, you get what everybody calls now, right, the financialization of the economy, which means it's all just bubble activity and a bunch of rich guys on Wall Street trading pieces of paper around as they get all their bonuses and their standard of living continues to increase at record paces while everybody else is treading water. And so it's supposedly a left-wing complaint. It's the complaint of certainly the mass of people that you have this further and further disparity between the, you know, so-called 1% and everybody else when it comes to income. And yet it's all this government intervention, all this paper money, all the deficit spending, and all the things that the right-wing old gold standard curmudgeons have opposed that have led to this, you know? And it's only going back on the gold standard that's ever going to bring it to an end.
Yeah, and at this point in time, I mean, when it comes to the political arena in the United States, I mean, the left-wingers in the Democratic Party supporting that Green New Deal, people around Bernie Sanders and so forth, they've come up with this idea, they call it modern monetary theory, in which they claim that, look, we haven't had a crash, a government funding problem, so we can just do this forever. And that's our theory, basically. That's what it comes down to. But then with the conservative movement, you know, it's, I don't hear people except Ron Paul and the Austrian economics people in the libertarian movement who talk about the deficit anymore or the gold standard or any of this kind of stuff. So we're in a weird political time. In which everyone is obsessed with Trump and not what's going on in the background.
Right. Well, and of course, big business benefits from all of this. So the right, broadly speaking, and the Republican Party and business interests, they're all for all of this stuff. It takes a real ideological gold bug to be so right-wing that he's left-wing on at pointing out the consequences of these policies. Yeah, people complain about all this income inequality to the nth degree, and essentially the entire consensus other than Ron Paul and you know, people who follow the Austrian school is to continue along the same policies or make them even worse, like you're saying, where the socialists are saying, hey, guys, it turns out that money is magic and you could just... If only we'd known all along that the government could give each of us a couple of million dollars to live our dream. Why not? What were we waiting for? That's their lesson. So there's really bad and then worse.
Yeah, and I don't know where, like I said, I'm pretty convinced the stock market's topping out and these bond, you know, the bond signals are suggesting the economy is going to at least slow down by the end of the year. But where is this heading in a year or two? I'm not, you know, is this going to start to blow up? I don't know, you know. But that's one of the sayings about bear markets, if I can get it right, is something like, if you're looking at the ocean, when the tide goes out, you see what's really there. So that's that's what we're going to see in the next couple of years. But the notion that we had the Cold War era, now we have the Trump era, this sort of, we've already seen politics change in the United States, with people getting, you know, all obsessed about who the president is, to put it simply. So where's this all taking us, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You look at the partisan divides going on right now and then compare that to after the current bubble pops. I mean, so much of this is because of the prior booms and busts.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, the next one is going to be a real SOB.
Yeah, so my recommendation, you know, to people.
Buy a rifle? Like,
yeah, no, just to buy gold and silver. That's the simplest thing people can do.
And a rifle.
Or food, cans of food and beans and stuff like that.
Well, you know, you said something important there earlier, too, about how you can't just evaporate all the real wealth in this country. Right. We all the trucks and all the highways and all the warehouses and all the machine tools and all of the everything I'm leaving out, all of that property and all that productive capacity. No crash can erase all of that. It's just they can knock it all back on its ass for a few years and make everybody have to start over again, essentially, with what they have left, which is what happens with this boom and bust. But even then, overall, you can't stop the growth of the economy and the productivity of America. It's always, even with these horrible booms and busts, it's still always a slow and steady upward trend.
Yeah, I mean, during the Great Depression, one of my grandfathers, my dad's father, he was a hobo on a train for a couple years. But my mom's side of the family, they had a farm, 100-acre farm out in Maryland, and they didn't even know there was a depression. So they're just growing their own food, you know, had cows and just operating their farm. That didn't even know, didn't feel it. That's what they told me. So, my grandma told me.
Their markets were local enough in the county or whatever that they just weren't affected by what was going on in the rest of it, huh? That's interesting.
Yeah. In fact, they had a neighbor. She had a farm, you know, this lady had a farm too across the street. And, when Social Security was created in the 1930s, she refused to sign up for it. Mm-hmm. So this lady never had a Social Security card her whole life. And I met her. But because of that, she didn't pay taxes. But she also didn't have a bank account.
Mm-hmm. And apparently, you know, she didn't sign up to become dependent on the State Department to get her exports for her livelihood.
No, I didn't do, just wasn't in the system at all. Right. It's just probably the only person I've ever met like that, but pretty crazy.
Yeah, no, that's great to hear that in America you still have, you know, in a sense, little plantations with their own self-contained economies there, assuming everyone is free to leave.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess those days are probably over now. I don't think anybody could get away with that kind of thing now. I guess there are some.
I doubt it.
There are some little intentional communities around, but not too many. Mm. All right. Well, listen, I learned lots of things, and I'm sorry that I don't know more so I could ask you smarter questions and stuff, but
that's great. It's good for the audience, too. You know?
Yeah, there you go. I think so. Speaking for them, you know, on their behalf, they agree with that. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you. Good talk with you.
All right, guys. That's the great Mike Swanson. Sponsors this show, by the way. There's your conflict of interest disclaimer designation. And you can sign up for his newsletter at wallstreetwindow.com and get all the news and his video blogs that he does about what's going on in the markets and all his different advice. And you got to read The War State. It's a great history of the rise of the military-industrial complex after World War II.
So Truman, Ike, and Kennedy years. You'll want to check that out. So you like supporting anti-war radio hosts. That makes sense. Here's how you can do that. Go to scotthorton.org/donate, and there's all kinds of options to do so and all kinds of different kickbacks at different levels. Of course, take PayPal, Patreon, and all different kinds of digital currencies and all of those sorts of things. And anybody who signs up by way of Patreon or PayPal to donate $5 a month to the show will automatically get keys to the Reddit room, my own private Reddit group that I have. Quite a few members now and lots of fun in there every day. So check out all about that at scotthorton.org/donate. And thanks.